good morning, everyone. Good morning. Right. I was about to ask the chairperson of the NCOP to come in because with my glasses, which are reading and not long vision, it looked as if he was standing in the doorway, but it is a photograph or a painting. Sit up there, but just in the right position of the door. Right. We would like to welcome the Director General, Mr. Lionel October, and also wish him well for the year formally on the committee. We've had a good relationship so far with you, working relationship, and I have no doubt it will continue in the future, very constructive. And we also have with us a delegation from the DTI, several of them represent or coming to give us a presentation on the economic zones. I'm sure it is draft bill, as I understand it. And they are, I'm not sure if it was an order of precedence, but the Chief Director of Special Projects, Mr. Kaya Ngaka. Oh, sorry, you know, my apologies to you. It just goes to show if your thumb is in the wrong place, that's why it's actually the DDG who is here, the Director General, the Deputy Director General of the Enterprise Organization, Mr. Tumela Chipfufa. Thank you. And Mr. Kaya Ngaka, right, Chief Director, Special Projects. Mr. Alfred Tao, Chief Director, Regional Development. I'm not sure if the SC Senior Council or the initials, because there's so many little names here, but it's a Mr. Nkuna. Is that right? Yes. You're not an advocate then?
No.
Director of Marketing and Shareholder Relations, Ms. Antoinette Bayepi, Director, Industrial Development Zone. Mr. Warren Smith, Deputy Director, Industrial Development Zones, and Professor Paul Benjamin, whom we've touched sides with before, Cheadle Thompson and Haysom Attorneys, Mr. Bongani Lukeli, Deputy Director, Media Liaison, and Mr. Dumasani Sombinge, Director, Legal. Whenever I see the name Cheadle Thompson and Haysom Attorneys, it reminds me directly of the struggle when, I think it was Mr. Haysom, was inside trying to play rugby for Christmas. They then confiscated his ball. But anyway, you know, it's just amazing how little photographs or images come to mind when you say certain names. Of course, now he's a highly respected mainstream struggle set of attorneys and so on. And of course, members, you are all highly welcome. Every time we've come here, there have been new members joining us in attendance. Well, they're old members, but I'll see them for the first year. And it is, of course, constructive to have representatives of, you know, the core political parties who are represented on the committee here now. So, right, and that was the IFP. So, if we can move then, thank you, members, to the apologies. And we have just one or two of them, and this time they are all in writing. Thank you. Mr. Suvandamurva is still away, but I should have said yesterday, the 24th and 25th, political commitments. Mr. Jacques Smaller is due to party commitments, not able to attend. I suppose that includes broader NGO. Ms. Labenia, who's the IFP, due to party commitments not able to attend, and Advocate Elvis, who was here yesterday, as well as Mr. Smuller, due to past party commitments not able to attend. Those are the only written apologies we have. Honourable Chief Whip, do you have any apologies?
Thank you for the promotion, Chairperson, that I'm a Chief Whip. I don't know whether Mr. Mutaka will appreciate that. Thank you, Chair. Up to so far, I never heard anything, any apology from anyone, Chair. Thank you.
Well, then we just don't have any apology from Honourable Kamala for 2 days, and we need to ascertain her well-being, just to ensure we are not overlooking something. Right. Now, the agenda is before us. We're on target, time and everything. Can we please have somebody looking here? You'll see one mini change. We put in, it is the final sort of passing of the drafted program. Remember, we made 2 minor changes yesterday due to the department indicating their difficulties and making one of the dates. So it's just back here. We have to pass it today, and I think you will process it then. Otherwise, it remains the same as you've seen before. We have someone to adopt the agenda, please.
Madam Chair, clarification, if I may. Are we going to get an opportunity to interact with the department on the presentation they'll give us? Is that opportunity what set out under deliberations? And if not, what is the deliberations in respect of?
Yeah, I'm not sure if you were just simply clarifying whether you wanted to ensure the deliberations were specifically on the economic zones. Is that correct?
Right. Is that what it is? It's our interaction on the presentation.
Yes, it's not deliberations about tea or anything else, no. So it's just on the economic zones, but perhaps in future we should be more specific. Yeah. Thank you very much. But useful to get that. It's a legal document after all. We have someone to propose the adoption.
Thank you, Honourable Harris. Thank you, Honourable
Harris. Well, I close. I hope we all know what I remember what I said yesterday, that please let's not apply the guillotine to 1 o'clock. We always allow a little flexibility of 10 or 15 minutes. Do you remember what we adopted yesterday? Just a little flexibility. So anyone making appointments, unless they need medical, should please try and take that into account and look at. Right, so immediately we can move on into Special Economic Zones Policy and Bill 2011. I do know this has been referred to for some time, and we are really looking forward as a committee, DG, to getting this input today from yourself. Over to yourself. And you know what sort of time people may be concerned. You know, there is a good hour, and of course we try to be flexible, as you know, and if the input can be retained to about 20 minutes or so, a little bit longer, gives us all time for an engagement on clarification, but you can continue for 40. I do want justice done.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We'll follow those guidelines and really try to allow enough time, as you say, for deliberation on the vote. Firstly, compliments of the season to you, Madam Chair, and the committee, and also, again, thank you for your your guidance and support in 2011. The department really appreciates the guidance and the absolute support we get from the committee. Madam Chair, as you indicated, towards the end of last year, Cabinet approved both a policy document and a draft bill for public discussion. So we're in the public participation phase. We're hoping to get inputs from the public, from the provinces, and we're also busy with simultaneously, whilst we want to get input from yourselves, we're also busy on a roadshow to all the provinces, local governments, to really try to build some national consensus around a special economic zones policy and then around the legislation. So I'll just take you through the main elements of our policy and also the main elements of the proposed legislation that we're hoping to introduce. But I'll see if I can start from sort of first principles. The first issue is just to define what is a special economic zone. Because, as I said, you get different types of things, and we'll show you later, different countries call it different things. We call it IDZ. Some people call it export processing zones, free zones, and so on. But really, the common factor in all of it is it's a special or a specific geographic area dedicated for industrial development and for targeted investments, and that's really, so we really, it's the question of a geographical area. And I mean, one must see SEZ as simply tools for economic development and specifically for industrial development. If you're just a mining economy, you don't need special economic zones because you just take the commodity out of the ground and you export it. But if you're going to develop an industrial base or a productive base, you need dedicated coordination between the public and private sector to develop an industrial base. And one of the tools that has been most successful in promoting industrial development across the world is this this SEZ tool, which we are hoping to further. Now, as I indicated, there are different countries and different zones, and some of the others that we looked at is that you get science and technology parks, you get the spatial development corridors, and as I said, there are different names, but the concept is really what we are trying to focus on when looking at IZZ. Before getting to our own situation, I think it's just important to note that while there have been some, SEZs globally have been a mixed story. There have been some very successful ones, and there have been some serious failures. If you take maybe some of the failures in Mexico, where they formed IDZs or EPZs, they led to very shallow industrialization. Even South Africa itself, pre-94, we had specific zones, and once the incentives dried up, the zones became ghost towns. There's been, as I said, there's been failures, but there's also been major successes. And I think we list the successes here, but really where they have been highly successful is in Asia and in the Eastern economies, China, Malaysia, and even in the Middle East, we've seen very, very successful IDZ. So obviously we're trying to learn what are the key lessons which makes these ones successful that we can apply to our own context. In South Africa's case, we introduced, IDZ was introduced in a very ad hoc manner. And we used the Manufacturing Development Act, which is a pre-94 legislation, to tack on as a sort of an extra the IDZ as a concept, and we've had it now for just over 10 years. We've had IDZs in South Africa. Now, the main aim of the IDZs, which we will just look at in some detail later on, the KUKAS and the London IDZ, is that the main focus was
was a strong export orientation. And therefore, one of the criteria for our IDZs, which you will see is a very limiting criteria, but is that you must have an international airport or a port or international airport as a precondition for IDZ. And the reason for that is simple, is that obviously an IDZ is one where you bring in the raw materials, you process it, and then you export it immediately. And that's why the need for an international port is really was seen as a prerequisite for IDZ. But as we will see, that whilst it plays an important role, it also limited our IDZs. So currently we have the four IDZs, which is obviously the biggest one is Kucha, then is London, Richards Bay, and then the OR Tambo, which is not yet fully functional, and then we are jointly working with province and local government on the Saldanha IDZ, which will be completed probably by June this year. We would be completing all the feasibility studies for the Saldanha IDZ, and that application will be will go through. So we will have five. That shows what has been the investment in IDZs thus far over the period, which is 5.3 billion. The bulk of that went into infrastructure for these zones, and it explains the amounts put out there. And then, what is the return on these investment? There's been 40 investments made and 11.8 billion of investments in these areas, and 33,000 jobs have been created through these ideas. Now, I think our view is that whilst I think there's clearly been some significant progress in our IDZs, and even just over the past 2 years, we have seen some significant investments coming in to our IDZs. We still believe that in terms comparable to many other countries, it is underperformance. We could have done much better, and we could do much better with IDZ program. So in terms of developing then now a new policy around IDZ, given that there's not been as successful as we would have liked, we needed to shift course and shift focus. And the reason for that is partly because of the limited success of IDZs, but also because our economic context has changed significantly. And I think the most significant context is the adoption of our industrial policy action plan. We now have, under the new administration, we have an explicit commitment from national government or from public sector to support and actively support private sector investment. So that's the new policy. As you know, before the recession, where there was a big debate to what extent should governments step in to assist the private sector to grow and to provide industrial policy support. Now, at least we've got an explicit program that we will step in a very bold manner through our industrial policy initiatives to promote industrial development and private sector development. So that's the political and economic context. And then in the global environment, there's also been a major shift. As you know, all our previous investments has been mainly from Europe, and now those countries are all close to recession, but they're also in severe financial distress. And there are new sources of FDI. We expect that 70 to 80% of new FDI will come from the new, let's say, from Asia and from the BRICS countries, and so on. So there is those new developments which we have to take into account. But also we've had now since our membership of BRICS, we've had much more interaction to be able to understand some of the lessons of what makes SEZ successful, because India, China, and Brazil have successfully used these things. So, as I said, we've now taken into account all the lessons. We've learned our own lessons about our own IDZs, and if we can then just summarize what are the key
weaknesses of the current IDZ program. The first weakness, as I indicated, is that because only a few people have a port or international airport, it is by nature limited to only three or four regions that could possibly have IDZs. So areas like Limpopo, Northwest, Free State are just excluded because there's no port and there's no... So we're punishing people for not having an ocean next to them. Secondly, there's the nature of support. We've learned, I think there was an overemphasis on just infrastructure development. But what makes IDZs very successful is a very strong logistics system, but also a very strong marketing of IDZs, especially for FDIs. And also the availability of the right mix of skills is important for IDZs. So in other countries, you have IDZs which are run by, you have dedicated ministers or even at the level of director generals running IDZs in China and other jurisdictions. But also they have, as I said, not only support in terms of infrastructure, but they have resources for marketing campaigns, for ensuring that there's a proper integration of the logistics systems in the zone and around the zones, and there's a proper skills development strategy. But most importantly, for all the other IDZs, they have dedicated legislation which allows for long-term planning. And South Africa, we've had real ad hoc, because there wasn't a national consensus around IDZs, and because funding was really on an annual basis or at most on a three-year basis, nobody could make serious investment. And as you know, all the IDZs can become successful after 10 years, and you can really see the success after 20 or 30 years. But it means you must have long-term planning for IDZs, which means you must have an upfront commitment with regard to planning, but with regard to the finance and the resources available. Currently, we drip-feed the IDZs every time they have to make an application and they have to conduct their lobbying to try to secure more finance. But it isn't like in other successful countries where they are given an amount of resources, and then they need to manage it effectively. So, Madam Chair, this is really the weaknesses we've identified in the current regime and the ones we will be addressing through the new policy and through the new draft bill. Just in addition to that is also just to mention the governance arrangements. Presently, our IDZs have no proper legal identity. Sometimes they're private companies. Sometimes they are, like in Kuha, they are subsidiaries of a regional development agency. Kuha is a subsidiary of the ECDC, and so on. So they all have different governance arrangements. So what we're trying to do with the new legislation is to lay out in statute what is the legal constitution of an IDZ. We also lay out, as I said, currently there's no roles and responsibilities between the three tiers of government. So sometimes the municipality has lukewarm support, sometimes it's the province championing it, sometimes it's national that supports it in different ways. But there's no legislation which sets out clearly the roles and responsibility of the three tiers of government, but most importantly of the two state agencies that play a critical role. ESCOM and Transnet are critical players in any IDZ, but there's no legislation which governs these government departments and institutions. So that's really the fundamental weakness of the current regime. So the first, as I said, this new policy is going to address those problems. The first thing is we're going to very clearly set out the governance arrangements. And the one absolute critical ingredient for success of IDZs is that the big five must work together, the three tiers of government. You have to have absolute consensus and commitment from the municipality, the province, and national government on IDZs. So that's why you will see later on in the bill what we say is applications can only be made by those three tiers of government, or they can do it jointly, or they can do it through a very dedicated public-private partnership. But you can't just have, I mean, the minister, when he takes into account proposals for IDZs, if it's just one tier and there's no consultation with the other tiers, those things are bound to fail, and that's why we must upfront get them right. So the bill quite extensively deals with the responsibilities, and then in the province, for example, the MEC will be responsible for managing the arrangements, for managing the local or the IDZs in that specific province will be guided by that. But at the upfront, for example, as we're doing in Saldanha at the moment, we all three-tier governments have been involved from the start, from the commissioning of the feasibility study, all three, the Saldanha municipality, the province, and national, we're working together throughout things. So obviously that assists then when we have to manage the new IDZ, and also from the upfront, we are involving Transnet and Eskom in this arrangement. Then we also, as I said, the new one the bill will try to address is this thing of the financing framework. You will see in the bill that we create the opportunity for long-term planning and for a predictable financing in the environment. So that's really the issues, the central issues the bill addresses. So, I mean, again, then I won't repeat the key aim is. So, if we then start with going into a bit more detail on the bill, we set out in the bill itself what are the fundamental purposes of the IDZ's SEZ's policy thrust. And then the one issue we have added here, and here I think we speak about the need for world-class infrastructure. Now, critical to any IDZ, as mentioned, was quality energy supplies and quality logistic or transport system. Because remember, as I said, in a IDZ, in a special economic zone, it's not like just taking iron ore and getting it to the port. But really, you have to fly in hundreds of thousands of components. If you take it's London or the Kuga IDZ, if there's an automotive plant, you have to bring in supplies from both locally and across the world. You have to add value, and then you have to export a value-added product, a C-class Mercedes-Benz or minibus and so on. And clearly, you need a very, very high-quality transport and logistics system. And then for beneficiation, what is absolutely critical and what we, what all the investors are telling us, they need a reliable supply of electricity. Even the cost can be adjusted, but what you can't have is a unreliable, and especially for beneficiation, where 25% of a steel plant is the cost of electricity. You need, it's absolutely essential. And as you will see when we come to the bill itself, we put on the board, there will be the representatives from Eskom and Transnet, so that when we plan these IDZs, there's coordination between electricity supply and the IDZ. So that sets out things. As I indicated, the new board, and it's just not that we want a board to be established, but this board will consist of all the major players in the IDZ so that we have proper and effective coordination. It will be senior representatives from the three main government departments, which is the DTI, the National Treasury, and most importantly, SARS will be on the board because, as you know, they have to manage the customs. A zone is also a customs-controlled area, which means you need the customs authority on board. So they will serve on the board, and as I indicated, Transnet and Eskom will also have senior representatives. And then there will be the independent experts in this area of regional industrial development and so on. So that board is it's both an advisory body to assess applications and to oversee the program, but most importantly, it's also to ensure that you have buy-in from all the critical departments. The second key provision is the Minister of Trade and Industry, together with the Minister of Finance, must establish a SEZ fund. So we will have a dedicated facility to be able to then provide sector-specific incentives. Now, again, just a word on this question of incentives, Madam Chair. Currently, let's say until last week, there are no IDZ-specific incentives that you get. Whatever you get in Kucha, you can get in the rest of the country. So there is no additional incentives for our IDZs currently. So what will happen and what our the lesson is from successful IDZs is that all of them have very, very, very attractive investment packages they offer, from tax allowances, grant funding, cheap electricity, and so on. So we will have that fund. But it's important to say that really incentives all over are not the main reason for the investment. It can only really be the cherry on top or the sweetener. But you cannot have, IDZs are not driven fundamentally by the incentives that you have. And I think South Africa has had an experience of that when, as you know, in Isitebe, Botshabelo, everywhere, Atlantis, close to us, there the government offered 7-year labor wage incentives. After the 7 years was up, the company just closed down and went back to where they originally came from because there was no incentive available. So what we will do is we will develop there must be a fundamental competitiveness and viability of the project that must make economic sense for the investor to come into the zone. And as I said, in addition to that, because we are competing with many other jurisdictions, we then will offer competitive tax incentives. And also, and last week, Madam Chair, we did amend the 12i scheme, where, as you know, there is the scheme available, but now for SEZs, they will get a slightly better package than the rest, so that we can attract that. So we've already put in place some of the, there's been an agreement between ourselves on our National Treasury now on the need for this dedicated fund and on the need for a specific incentive. Then the other major one is to deal with this problem of only 4 IDZs and only certain provinces. We've now expanded the concept of IDZ, and it's no longer a precondition that you must have an international port or airport. You could, for example, serve regional markets. So, for example, in Limpopo, you could have a agro-processing zones or a platinum zone, and you could service both the South African market, or you could take a rail via Durban or via Maputo. And also, so we're allowing it for all the regions now to be able to apply. So that's why we're moving away from the term IDZ, and that's why we're talking about different categories of special economic zones. So you will see in the Act sometimes if people need to have an industrial park, we can accommodate that. If, for example, you have, for example, in platinum beneficiation, that is more because they have a stage of R&D, you can have a science and technology park dedicated as a SEZ. So we allow for much more different kinds of regions and activities to also. So we hope, and we are busy, I mean, as you know, this legislation went through our MINMEC processes and it's been through the provinces for extensive consultation. But we hope every province will be having 1 or 2 SEZs. And we are currently engaged with Limpopo, with Northwest, with the Free State, on the identification of potential SEZs for those provinces. As I indicated, the other important element for successful IDZ is the long-term planning. Now, again, unfortunately, unlike the business community and the Asian countries in the West and South Africa following the West, we've moved away from long-term planning. And what we see was successful was 5-year plans in China, in India. So what we're saying is that now every IDZ must come up with a proper plan which they must submit to national government on the proposed activities for the year. So as I said, we're trying to build into the legislation a commitment that it's not just ad hoc, that is long-standing taking place, he said. And then as I indicated, the applications, we're really trying to build this partnership approach where all three tiers of government must work together from the start to make an application for IDZs. Then the other issues which is going to be important for successful IDZ. The first is we're going to need a national marketing strategy. Currently, IDZs actually compete with each other, and they fight for the same investors, and they also see it as a big loss if somebody decides to go to East London rather than Kucha or vice versa. And so on. So there's a unnecessary competition and so on. What we are going to be having is, because we're going to have the national board, it will be coordinated investments, and we will the DTI will jointly market together all the IDZs and SEZs together, and each one of them has a unique value proposition, and we will work on a joint marketing strategy amongst the BRICS countries, but internationally. The second element is capacity building. As we can see, there's now many countries. Singapore especially have offered us, where they've run successful zones, really the capacity building for both the public and private sector to operate these zones, to provide adequate training for officials for this. And then again, as I indicated, the question of logistics is going to be key. I think this slide just lays out again some of the key points that we will take into account in the new. It's important to emphasize, for example, because sometimes people see this environmental protection as a constraint. But actually the experience of IDZs is that the IDZs that really survive in the long term are those that have become environmentally sustainable. So in the Saldanha IDZ, there's a marine protected area. The environment is a key element of it. Similarly, along the east coast. So we need to ensure that if we're looking at developing zones for the next 20, 30 years, we must see that they are completely consistent with preserving and protecting the environment. But what we will build in is a speeding up of processes around obtaining necessary permits and so on for these IDZs. Okay. Then we, whilst we're busy with the legislation, we've also put into the bill transitional arrangements, because as I said, we don't want anything to stop. For example, with the Saldanha application, we will either process it under the existing legislation even if you are registered under the existing legislation, you will automatically proceed towards having your license for the new legislation, so that there's no vacuums and no interregnums in these processes. And then, as I indicated, the most important element that we have we've reached consensus on is with the National Treasury, is on a long-term financing model for these IDZ. So whilst the bill doesn't go into any detail, we just say we will create a special IDZ fund, because I think that just creates the legal space for the minister to create that fund. But obviously the details is being negotiated, or the amount is being negotiated with the Treasury simultaneously as we carry on. Then, Madam Chair, to bring us to a conclusion and to allow for the deliberation, as I indicated, we've issued it for public comments. We're busy with the roadshow. We're also simultaneously busy working with the provinces on the actual identification of feasibility studies for the IDZs or SEZs. In the provinces, that process will be done simultaneously with a consultation process. And similarly, we are working at also just strengthening the current IDZs, that we don't also shift focus completely, but we have to strengthen the ones. And at the end of last year, we started the new, where we took 80 manufacturing companies to China. We also took all the IDZs then with us, and we're developing a project proposal which incorporates all our the existing IDZs into one marketing packages, which we presented to the Chinese as investment opportunities. So as I indicated, we're already trying to in a sense, action what we hope will be adopted as our new policy. And then, obviously, we hope that the committee will, after these deliberations, be able to put in place the and you have vast experience on this matter, is to process the bill itself so that we could have a proper governance framework in place for you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. I just wanted to clarify how you were perhaps on this point, because given to me, it's not only the material for that input that you have just covered, but also the draft economic zone discussion. Now, I would assume that that was also just for us to
Ms. Mendel, as you recall, both from Cabinet and for yourself, the first part is really to provide the policy framework and the strategy. And as I said, once the broad policy and is sort of accepted, then I think we can go into the details of the bill itself, and then I think, as I said, but in any case, we can already deal with some questions because we have our lawyers here with us who have drafted the bill, but we can go, but I think maybe the next step would be line by line going through the bill itself.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's just that I would like to about 10 to 11 at this particular point in time. And what I'm looking at is possibly members can begin with deliberations at this, not deliberations of course entirely, but comments, questions, clarification. And we can then, after that, have our consideration of them. Honourable Khadebe, right, Honourable McIntosh, right, and Honourable Ambrosini, and Honourable Mabasa, Honourable Harrison. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairperson. First of all, I'd also like to welcome the department to 2021. Let's hope that it will be a fruitful year again as 2011 was. So, but Chair, what is also critical there, first of all, I'd like to appreciate this presentation because it goes to the heart of our oversight report, which we undertook in 2010 when we went to the Eastern Cape, in particular to Kuha Industrial Development Zone, whereby the challenges of governance and finance were raised sharply by the stakeholders at that level. I think that this bill goes a long way in addressing those issues which were raised. Because as we're speaking now, is that what was the role of the metro, what was the role of the province, national, to upon. So we have that lacuna, those gaps which could not be filled. And I think that with this proposed bill, somehow it is being addressed, those issues which were raised there. But also at the same time, Chairperson, I've just looked at the draft bill here. I saw here when they spoke about the board, you know, the board of this event, Special Economic Development Zone. I can see the stakeholders which were identified there, but I can see one serious omission is the civil society and the labor, organized labor. Because part of the package is that when you are having this zone, you are stimulating the economy. So in the process, you are creating jobs. You know. But at the same time, you have to emphasize the quality of jobs which you are emphasizing. So what was the rationale behind the draft that they permitted such key stakeholders, the civil society around that place, where of course those are the guys who will be benefiting one way or the other when coming to the issue of that special economic zone? And then also one of the aspects of the special economic zone is there's a tendency of trying to relax the labor laws when coming to deal with this issue. As the DG has alluded, that when we went to Stebe, when we went to Kwakwa, and then even there in Adventist, there was special labor dispensation. You relax some laws so that you can promote that. So I don't think that would be advisable to do when the organized labor is not part of the deal, even the civil society around that. Because some will say that organized labor, they already got jobs. But the civil society around that area, I think there must be have some sort of a way of feeding into the system, Chairperson. And then I'll rest it there so that I can take the second bite. Thank you, Chair.
Yes, I should have mentioned to members what I would appreciate really is the input being kept to 2 minutes maximum and one or two questions on the first draft.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think it's a very exciting presentation, and I really want to congratulate the director and his team, and I think that's one of the great benefits of getting into BRICS, because I think it stretches our horizons and it gives us new ideas, and we have them as examples of growing economies, which we've got to keep up to. I don't want to get into the debate about decent jobs and any jobs, which my colleague Honourable Khadebe started, but that's another one. I do just have wish to make one comment. I like this term hard and soft infrastructure. I don't think one must underestimate the importance when you're getting industrial development zones of what's already there, like a golf club. Now, that may not be that. I know some people said it was elitist for the ANC to have had golf as part of its 100th anniversary, but there are people who love golf, and most of them have got money, and or else they're senior management, and they're going to make a contribution. So in ladies of KwaZulu-Natal, they only had a 9-hole golf course. They tried to get an 18-hole, but they didn't. I think they would have done better at their Isikebe Center if they'd had an 8-hole. So I'm just saying as a soft... don't underestimate schooling, facilities, and even a nice game park nearby. Life is not just work, so people want quality of life as well. But I have one query. Richards Bay, if I look at, I've also just read this document, Richards Bay seems to have everything in place to be a really good IDZ and SEZ. It's got a company owning it. It's got the support of the KwaZulu government. It had Itala Bank behind it. But it's had pathetic support in terms of investment. Of course, the trade industries have done very little there. I don't know if that was a political one because they weren't very sympathetic to the KwaZulu provincial government until recently. Now, I just am a bit puzzled because I would have thought the Richards Bay was a natural for a really successful IDZ. Okay, that's all I really want to ask. The last question I just want to point out is that, as the Director General alluded to it, we've had a lot of efforts at distributing industrial. And let's not forget a history. There's, of course, an Industria, and there's Ekandustria, and all these places which had strong ideological social engineering elements. But they also, many of them can teach us lessons of their failures, but also some of their successes. Newcastle has been very successful, largely because they attracted a lot of Chinese industrialists many, many years ago. And the same in Bronkhorstspruit, Ekangala. I mean, we don't know, perhaps the biggest Buddhist temple outside of Asia is in Bronkhorstspruit, built by the Chinese community that came to build factories there. So let's not forget our history, because we can learn a lot from a lot of mistakes. And I'm sure DTI has somewhere the kind of institutional memory to dig out of some of that stuff. Although this is fresh and new and exciting. And Madam Chair, I must say, I'm very pleased to be, as a South African, to be part of this whole process. And I'm not making a pitch to be put on the board. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. thank you to the Honourable McIntosh for mentioning all the achievements of Prince Michael Futu Kutalesi in KwaZulu-Natal. And I want to say that my interventions in this debate and future debates have gone in support. I support the idea. The IFP was the first party to table a formal proposal for a United States in 1993 in the Constitution of KwaZulu-Natal and adopted them. However, as the Director General pointed out, there are many of such initiatives, many have failed. The line between success and failure is one which needs to be taken very seriously and not just at the policy level. We all want it, but we need to create the conditions which make it succeed. If we look at the present IDZ, 5.3 billion rands went in, 11 billion rands of investment, for a 5% return. At this present rate, these things will not be economically viable from a financial viewpoint in 200 years. That there is no way of repayment or repaying what the country has put into it in terms of what comes out financially. So the first question is, if this didn't work there where there are airports, infrastructures, harbors, why would it work there where there aren't such natural advantages? The second question which is connected, it is not a matter of marketing, and you know that you can market whatever you want, it's a matter of what the product is. And the product is incentives. And the DG pointed out that the IDZ didn't have enough incentive, not tax incentive. Well, they were given things, but they were not given tax breaks, labor breaks, etc. The reason why these projects did not work in Europe and were declared unconstitutional, and that's an issue that we need to deal with, but worked in the East where the constitutional constraint did not exist, is that you can't have a guy manufacturing in the IDZ not paying taxes or paying a lesser measure of taxes or not respecting the Labor Relations Act or having different minimum labor standards, and the guy doing exactly the same thing outside that zone, being subjected to a different tax and legislative regime. So the bill doesn't deal with that and does not even give the statutory authority to the minister or ministers to deviate from the law of the country. So what are these incentives made of? Because there is no statutory backing on what you've drafted. And if they don't go that far, then the competition with those which gives some actual tax break is going to be such that in all likelihood will spell the non-success of this project, which I support. The third and final question, Madam Chairman, is the notion of long-term planning. We know what goes in, and it's going to be a huge amount of money, even without conceding to the idea of my friend here of building golf courses, and it's going to be public money. We know what came out on the IDZ, which is very little, because 11 billion, it's investment, it's not a return for the country. There might not be even a return for the country in financial terms. So if we go on the long-term planning, which has proven not to be viable in the past, are we not freezing money on a huge bet? Wouldn't it be better just to give the tax incentives, give the advantages and let the market regulate what goes in there? Thank you.
Yeah, I just want to make it clear to members, it's not 4 minutes or 5 minutes. We're trying to stick to a limited time on the first round. Please, all of you, there will be another round. Okay? We move on now to Honourable Mabasa.
Also expressing appreciation, DG, input made. My question is, as we contribute and as we assist in the development of the industrial economic zones, do we also consciously say how to bring in more people to work? But I'm saying this in the context of how do we make sure that they benefit many across the country. In other words, are there precautions that are taken so that we don't have over exploitation of labor to a point where as a country we win something but we find we lose out of proportion? Thanks, Comrade Chair.
Thank you very much. Honourable
Harris. Thanks, Chair. If the WIP is going to lobby for the union to be included on the board, then I have seen good faith lobby for the opposition to be on the board as well. Now, in all seriousness, Chair, I do appreciate the spirit of cooperation, which the DG underlined repeatedly, between the spheres of government, particularly because the example used is actually between two different parties running those spheres. The one concern would be the issue around coordination later, where you speak about centralized marketing. I think we need to realize the benefits of competition between the provinces and not necessarily contradict them with too much what you call coordination, so perhaps some insight into balancing that. Secondly, Chair, I think the most accurate thing that DG said is that he made a statement the bill doesn't go into any detail in a particular area. The reality is the bill doesn't go into any detail in many areas at all. It essentially just sets up a framework for establishing a board and the process of designations and operations. Now, there's an upside and a downside to this. The upside is it's coming to Parliament, and I think it's Parliament's duty to provide a lot more of that content, because right now it's a blank slate. The downside would be is if Parliament doesn't get the chance to do that, then you're effectively legislating at arm's length. If this bill goes through anything like it looks right now, Parliament will have no say over anything to do with this policy space. And I don't think this committee can allow that to happen. We have to avoid that. And again, I would appreciate some comments on legislating at arm's length. Thirdly, Chair, as my colleague, Mr. Ambrosini, alluded to, the reason why the IDZs haven't worked is because the incentives aren't strong enough. And the two that the DG has touched on that are missing are tax incentives, proper international competitive tax incentives, and then labour market reforms. I'm interested in the position of SARS and the Treasury on the one hand when it comes to tax incentives, and the Department of Labour and other stakeholders on the other. I mean, these two issues, from my reading of the Treasury, have blocked stronger tax incentives up until now. Call it what you will, but that's what I call it. And the Labour Department and other stakeholders have blocked labour market reform. So does the DG see a new willingness to tackle those two issues now? Chair, the IDZs, according to the figures the DG presented, created jobs at the rate of 160,000 rand per job. Provided that those jobs, the 33,000 jobs created, are direct jobs rather than indirect jobs, I'd like some clarity on that. Is it actual jobs created in the IDZs, or is a multiplier applied to calculate the indirect jobs? Either way, we're talking about a cost per job of around 160,000. Does the department have a figure that would be better value for the country? I mean, is 160,000 excessive, considering that government estimates the youth wage subsidy would create jobs at around 37,000 rand per job, right up to, I think, some of these calculators that are auto subsidies probably create jobs at around 200,000 to 600,000 rand per job. I'm interested in how we position the jobs created in an SEZ in the menu of options available to government. So one last question quickly, Chair.
So we would like at this point, Honourable Copsey, the Secretary indicated you had raised your hand. Is that correct?
Yes.
Can you raise
2 minutes, please.
Thank you, sir. I would want to say to ask the DG, we are always reminded by the outside people that our education and training doesn't match the skills needed in this country. And perhaps, how has the department interacted with higher education department? Because amongst the bodies and organizations consulted, it isn't mentioned. Because with the promotion of the FET colleges now, we think that it should be a necessity, actually, to promote that, because our skills must match the kind of economy, the skills that we need for our economy to grow in this country. And perhaps that's why we would have a lot of students graduate, not actually are unemployable. The second one is our visit to Kuha. We learned that there are other companies there that still import a lot of material, and that is actually iron, which we have in South Africa. I would want to know, how is the department doing to actually look at those kinds of actually skills and resources that we have, the minerals that we have in South Africa, rather than exporting that, actually develop? Because ArcelorMittal, I can't remember what is this part, but I would remember, they were saying, no, they can't do that, economically it's not viable. But smaller people can actually start up, especially at these, start this up and actually even export. So I would want to know, how is the department encouraging that? Thanks.
Very much. What you'll do now, if you don't mind, is to have the response to those points raised. But you're still going to have more time afterwards, in which you'll raise another round. I think the members are aware. Fine. Over to yourself, Judy.
Thanks, Madam Chair, for those comments and questions. Firstly, I think if I can just maybe just go through the order in which it was presented, and then Tumelo will follow up with some of the other questions. I think the critical issue raised by Honourable Member Khadebe and followed up about that is the omission of labour from an NGOs, maybe from the board. I think that I'll try to address that maybe in the context of the overall issue of labor reform and labor things. But I think, as I said, the first purpose of the board is we wanted a very, very dedicated board with a very, as we said, this is a tool for industrial development, which means we mustn't give it tasks of things like collective bargaining or consensus building and so on. Its only task must be to promote industrial development, get in private sector investors to invest, see that the state does its job of providing the infrastructure, and that it must be single-minded focus, and that's why I think we don't want to change its focus by including other players. Now, having said that, so that's why I said the key players must be, you must have the key players in that IDZ, and especially our two major, those who supply our electricity and those who supply our transport. Eskom and Transnet are critical, and then the government departments. They indicated we must have SARS from the beginning, National Treasury must be from the beginning. It mustn't be that within government we must lobby each other for things. We must jointly make decisions about these things. So that is why that board has been conceptualized as it has. Then maybe I should then deal with the issue of labor reform. I think if you look at the international experience of IDZs, those who have failed are those who have deregulated the labor regime and who have relied on cheap temporary labor. So the biggest ones who failed is the ones, if you take Mexico, if you take the ones in on the Caribbean islands, the typical export processing zones. Now, firstly, what they did was they brought in, and it's similar to our experience, they brought in and they did mainly light manufacturing, clothing and textile, cheap plastics, cheap electronics. They did in these EPZs.
and their main export was then into the United States market. And as I indicated, when the East came into the picture, they couldn't compete with the other regions and all of them because their only competitive advantage was their cheap labor. So when another region came with more cheap labor, they had to leave. Just like we had in South Africa, where we had people in Isithebe and Botshabelo, when Maseru came along and Lesotho offered better incentives or even cheaper labor than Botshabelo, the Taiwanese packed up, literally packed up, and left because their only advantage they relied on was that. So it is not sustainable if you're building an IDZ for 20, 30 years. To just rely on cheap labor is not the solution. So what? That's why I'm saying the labor movement must have no fears that these IDZs are not, that's not going to be our competitive advantage. Our competitive advantage is going to be quality infrastructure, quality logistics system, but also very competitive if we have much more skilled labor. And if we, as we're doing, for example, in the Saldanha, if you have proper plan, you identify what are your comparative advantages in a particular area. So, for example, in Saldanha, there's massive comparative advantage we could have in the production of in the oil and gas industry. So the oil and gas, because as you know, there's gas fields being discovered all over, we can be a supplier and we can be a major player in the oil and gas sector. But that is the industry which is, as I said, it's not going to be based on cheap labor. It's going to be if we can provide the superior engineering services, we can relocate the oil and gas from presently the oil tankers have to go to Singapore for repairs. And as I said, we're doing some of it already, but we can play a much bigger role and so on. So as I said, IDZ must be built on a natural economic comparative advantage. And the question, and as we said, and I'll also then comment on Mr. McIntosh, you see the, some of the unsuccessful, and as I indicated, the successful ones was where they were linked to an existing industrial area. Because there was an existing demand, there was existing skills, there was but if you try to artificially social engineer IDZ, it doesn't have a fundamental economic rationale. And then I think those ones. So as I said, I don't think labor reforms is a necessity. Even in China, the biggest danger some of those IDZs face is because ultimately after these workers come in, they get completely underpaid and exploited, as you saw in the outbreaks of labor strikes. Because once workers come together, they are going to organize for higher wages, and you can't permanently exempt them. So I think the Chinese are moving very quickly to bring the IDZ into the normal and to start paying people higher wages and to move away from exploitative labor practices. So I would say if you want to destroy your IDZ, is to focus on labor exploitation as your economic advantage. The point made by that's Mr. Khadebe. Mr. McIntosh, I think the point about the lifestyle is taken, and I think I think it's more made a comment. And I think, yes, we have learned, even in our own experience, they all have been successful. Let's say of those old RID regional industrial schemes, some have worked, as you indicated. And the most important one is the lesson that I think to highlight of Mr. McIntosh is that those that were integrated into the local economy and were not artificially created, those ones are much more successful than others. I think going to Mr. Honourable Member Ambrosini's point, I think that the key question he relates is you create a differential regime for those in the IDZ and those outside, and that has always been the dilemma. And I think up to now, even within ourselves and within National Treasury, they've always said we mustn't create tax incentives for only some because it reduces your tax base and your tax revenue if you exempt and you give these massive tax holidays. for some, and then people just immediately 5 kilometers away, they have to pay these things, and you have this uncompetitive. I think if we look at, I think to resolve this issue in our minds and in our study of the IDZs, which the team did, I think what we mustn't, what we must look at, I think that we say in our industrial policy that in general, we must favor certain kinds of economic activity and not others. Now, we must favor industrial and productive activities over non-productive activities like, say, financial services or retail. I think we're saying that in general we must have a bias towards productive sectors. So that's why we're saying you must differentiate it even within an economy. And then I think the question is, after a long debate, there's now consensus with ourselves and National Treasury that what we've seen, whether we like it or not, whether we agree with it or not, but all IDZs do offer something more than they offer in the general, and that's why companies have located there. I mean, it's just a practical fact that they offer better incentives. So what we have looked at, as I said, with the 12i scheme, and it's already done, we've agreed that whilst you'll get a tax incentive for if you locate anywhere in South Africa, but you will get a slightly better one if you also locate. So that gives us, especially when we go on international road shows, if you offer that, you can then persuade companies to locate within the IDZ. But as I said, it is a big issue for debate and discussion, and that's why we want this consultation process. And I don't think we're going to resolve it immediately, the question of differential incentives. I think, Honourable Member Mabasa's point, I think how does the broader community and people benefit from IDZ? The sustainable jobs can only be created in your industrial sector. So the contribution of IDZ is simple. It will be high-quality jobs because it's in the manufacturing sector. And secondly, we're not saying it explicitly, but of course if you create and you expand your productive base, you expand your employment, you create opportunities for graduates to work in more value-added jobs and so on. And I think that's the contribution that makes. I think, Honourable Harris's point, I think that, we want to strike a balance between national marketing campaigns and then also allowing for provincial sort of autonomy. I think our main focus is that we're saying at the national level, DGI will promote all the IDZs. And we will take joint packages, especially to the BRICS countries and so on. But obviously, the province itself must also market itself and must also have the complete autonomy to do that and so on. We're just saying that we have many times where all the provinces go to the same investor. And I think that in that level, DTI will play a more active role in trying to sort of coordinate a bit more and that's where the board will play a role. I think also Honourable Harris have raised the issue of the cost per jobs. I think that firstly, capital labour ratios, depending on the IDZ, they will have different job creation. So if you take the one in that's proposed in the Free State or in Limpopo, that will be mainly agro-processing. There, the labour intensity is very high if you're dealing with agricultural products. If you're dealing with one where maybe oil and gas or steel industry, there the capital ratios are very different. It's billions of investment and 100 jobs in a steel plant. But I don't think it is the job of government to get involved in capital labor ratios. I think it's for the company to work that out. And therefore, I don't think we can mechanically apply the cost per jobs. The job of the state is to provide infrastructure. We must supply electricity. We must supply the roads, the bulk infrastructure. That costs. But remember, those investments are forever. So I don't think one can mechanically say because you build a road or you get the port constructed and you only create. The state must do its job. Let the market determine how much As I said, because we're trying to create a diverse manufacturing base, we will have some capital-intensive sectors, like autos, components will be more labor-intensive. We'll have a clothing and textile, which is highly labor-intensive on the clothing side, capital-intensive on the textile side, but you need both. You can't have a clothing industry without a textile industry. Agro-processing, very capital. So I'm just saying this whole debate about capital relations is something which I don't think is a matter for the state to worry about, but it's for the private sector to look at, and we must just provide quality infrastructure, which we haven't done before. I think then, Honourable Member Kotsi, I think the skills issue is something which, as you could see in the Industrial Policy Action Plan, we've now put skills in last year's adaptation of the plan. We've added skills as the main issue because, unfortunately, as you know, we disrupted our apprenticeship system in the country, and now we're trying to revive that whole system. But clearly, this will be one of the critical tasks of the IDZs to ensure that we have a skilled labor available to be able to offer. And already in the current IDZs, there's work around that, that we can tell an investor, if you need so many technicians, so many people, that is part of the offering that we make to investors is skilled labor. So we are, the skilled element will be. And then the final point of Honorable Kotsi is the upstream issue. As I indicated, in terms of our upstream sectors, in terms of steel, in terms of chemicals, we have still monopoly producers in South Africa. So, for example, in steel, lots of it is imported by Mittal. Mittal both produces here and then they import because they basically control the South African market. They set the prices, and that, as I said, that is the one thing we are working very actively. And that was also on our trip to China, which was towards the end of last year, is to bring in another steel producer so that you have competition in that marketplace. So that we, as you say, we have the iron ore. And what the investors asked us there is that they said there's two things you must, if they are going to invest in South Africa, you must supply two things. They must supply reliable electricity, and you must supply the raw material, the iron ore, must be available for supply. And that will make them make the decision to invest billions. But unless they get security of supply on those two elements, you're not going to attract investment. So so that is how I think we can have to, we can add value to our products. But as I said, we have to supply those two conditions for that.
DG, on the issue of jobs, the 33,000 jobs are both direct jobs in the sectors that are employing people and also direct jobs. All of them are direct jobs and the other jobs are in construction. And in terms of having a target value or rent per job created, I think the DG has covered that quite a lot in the sense that we don't have we have not established a target in terms of the infrastructure that we are building of a static target of rent per job, because infrastructure by its very nature supports quite a lot of economic activity. The infrastructure that we've put in Guha is supporting the jobs that we've established, but it's going to support the expansion of the economy in Guha. And so as we go along, you know, and as that economy develops, the rent per job figure is going to come down to concentrate on a static figure of rent a job, you know, for building a boat, it would not be a very meaningful guide or of how we should be investing in the IDZ. Yeah.
Thank you very much for the moment. This is not the conclusion of our questions, clarifications, or deliberation. So I know, DG, the team will remain with you until after tea. What we are going to be doing now, members, just for 5 minutes or so, will be the minutes that you have of the 18th of January. There weren't many here. just so that you're aware of, he was here. You had Fubs, Kwabasa, Van der Merwe, Harris, Muller, McIntosh here. I'm just saying, you know, you were present at the meeting, so that there he goes. Pardon? Well, I'm not sure why not. They were distributed, not now, but some time ago. Others have got them, so perhaps you can just get a copy. Right, that's, of course, on page one, the Wednesday, the 18th of January. It was held a public hearing on the Gambling Review Commission's report with specific reference to online gambling. Now, what we did have here in attendance, some of we will recall them, songs, etc. Those who raise your hands if you have a problem with the accuracy of one, page one, page two. Your colleague did have a copy, but you're entitled to have received one already. The adoption of the agenda, the input from Professor von Solms, and several issues that emerged, which the committee was really seized with those issues and learned a lot. From the minors. The input of page 3 from Vic Fair. That was Tuxworth at Parks. And again, the focus on different issues there. But quite obviously and frankly, they were giving a positive approach to the matter, which one would have expected anyway. And the closure was at 12:30. Right. Those members who are present, do you have any issues to raise in terms of the accuracy of pages 2 and 3? We have had the minutes for some time. Seeing as we don't have any, I just see smiles and people looking a little weary. Can we have someone to propose adoption of the minutes? Thanks, Honourable Kwabasa, seconded by Honourable Harris. Thank you. You see how quickly that went. Now for the minor program changes. Minor. We studied this yesterday, and really it was just an issue, I think, of the 14th. Yes, but it changed
from the 15th.
Yes. On page 1, the 15th of February, in which we did have and still have noted, which shouldn't be there, but of course the department may wish to make certain references, is the RTC. However, as the commissioner will be in India at the time, we have rescheduled her input to the 29th, Wednesday the 29th of February. You see that there. That is the only change. Now, quite clearly, this is always subject to certain exigencies that arise in Parliament. But as it stands, within the parliamentary program, we don't see a challenge, and we would like this now to be formally adopted so that we can send it to the Mr. Froelich, the Honourable Froelich, the House Chair in charge of all committees. We have someone to propose adoption, please. Thanks, Honourable Khajebe, seconded by Honourable McIntosh. And on that very sharp point, can we please go to tea and please return? Shall we make it 7 minutes to 10? We will start sharply and in 10 minutes. Sharp. Honourable Harris, just 1 minute, please. Not even a minute. I'd say about 10 seconds. No, for yourself. No, the rest can go to tea. But I don't think anyone wants to do that. Right. So we continue now with deliberations, and of course that's all the questions, comments, clarifications, and we're into a second round, as it were. Are we all agreed on that? So we have Honorable Bilal, who had his hand up, and I said he'll come in as in the second round. Then we have Honorable Harris as well, who said he still had another question, unless it has been answered, so I'm just looking at Honorable Harris. And then, of course, everyone else wishing to come in again. Now, I do want members to get a clear understanding. This is not a committee of one person. I myself am watching how long I speak. So I do not dominate any proceedings. So I want you to do the same thing. All of us. So it's 2 questions or 2 minutes. 1 question over 2 minutes. Bring it through. But obviously, I don't cut you off the moment it goes into seconds. So immediately, Honorable Salah, followed by Honorable Harris, followed by Honorable Hadebe, followed by Honorable Oriani and Rossini. Any other hands? Honorable McIntosh, not that that's a clear invitation, but right. In that order, please.
Chairperson, I don't have the stopwatch, so you stop me. My first question, Chairperson, is that there is motivation to focus on the location of this SEZ in the port or the airport where they can be dealing with transportation of exportation. My understanding is that in the process of building this, we will be creating a buying power locally. What informs the idea that they can only be successful if it is for export purposes, without looking at the development of the buying power internally, which would then also require, of course, a lot of those products that would be moving out of the ZES. The second question is the composition of the board. In the presentation, I understand that the implementers of the decision in respect to industrialization would be the private sector. I'm just asking myself whether it is feasible to exclude them where issues are being looked at and decisions are being arrived at, and to think they can be effective in implementing decisions they don't know much about. Maybe we should look at the role of the private sector and how they get involved in the process of decision making. The third question is, if time allows, we refer here to marketing, capacity building, skills development, infrastructure, and logistics. I hope there is a link between this particular implementation, as reflected here, and the process of beneficiation, as we always talk about. Thanks, gentlemen.
Thank you. Honorable Harris?
Thanks, Chair. I'd like to ask the DG, is Treasury, as far as he knows, prepared to go beyond what he calls the slightly better 12i scheme? I understand that that's on the table, but the reality is SEZs around the world are offering much bigger tax incentives, including tax holidays, as you specified. And this thing will live or die based on Treasury's preparedness to go down that road. The next question is about the fund. What would the options be for capitalizing that fund? then the IDVs, existing IDVs, there's some confusion about whether they would automatically become SEVs. Can you just clarify that process of transitioning? And then, Chair, I'd like to know what the DG would say if we amended this in Parliament so that a private company could apply for a designation. Because I see a private company could become an operator, which is fine, but why do we restrict the designation applications to governmental-type organizations? And then, lastly, Chair, the IDVs, as you said, were linked to a particular port or airport. A lot of countries go further and have an export processing zone where the production from the area has to be exported, obviously to prevent spillovers into the rest of the economy. I mean, is that something that we would consider? There's not too much talk in the documentation about that, those kind of conditionalities, but has the DTI looked at that structure at all, and would it prevent some of the downsides that the DG was talking about in terms of even perhaps labor law? But yeah, there's not too much talk about conditionalities around exporting the products of these zones.
Thank you very much. That Honourable Hadebe.
Sir, thank you again for the second bite. I think I'm going to take only a minute. I'm again rising on the response of the DG from the question I raised earlier to the Chief of the Board. Chairperson, I'm happy that once the board envisaged the relaxation of labor laws, I think that's a critical aspect. Number two, I'd also like to advise the DG that, you know, on the 8th of January, I turned 100 years. I turned 100 years because every time the people were at the center of whatever I did. So I like, but what is good about it, this thing is still a process. We're still going to engage with it. I don't think that any good outcome will ever come if the people are not at the center. That's why even in Parliament, in our emblem, we say we, the people. Finish it, we, the people. That's what we say, we, the people. So I think that even when coming to development, and the job creation, the people must be at the center. I think that as we discuss the bill, we also have to put it into how the people can be involved in the areas where the EPZs will be. Number two, Chairperson, is the appreciation that the issue of ports and airports are no longer going to be considered, because the issue of unemployment is a national problem. Each and every province has got that problem, but I think that what we must go further. We can actually say that at least a particular province cannot have less than two special economic development zones, so that must be an instruction, so that we also harness the capacity of those provinces. Even if they are asleep, the department national must check them up, so that they will have to deal with this issue of unemployment. I think that this one is a good opportunity for doing that. That's where I'll end my comments.
Thank you very much. Yeah, that's a very good 2 minutes. Thank you. Can we move on? Thank you. I think it's Honourable McIntosh, is it?
Madam Chair, you were talking about Cheadle. Well, I can tell you about John Copeland and Harriet Bolton and a few other people, because I was involved when Philip Frame was building factories in Pinetown. And at the time, and that's the point about a holistic approach. By the word holism, Madam Chair, is a good South African word, its origins, and the first book on holism was written by General Jan Smuts, who was a philosopher of some importance. But the point is, what happened at those frame factories is the people were given contracts and nowhere to stay. So Claremont became a huge urban mess, very good for the property owners, because they rented out John Dorlos and built rows of rooms. So I suppose that was free market working well, if you like it that way. But the point is, there was no housing provided. And I believe if we're going to have these development zones, it's actually a process of urbanization, and therefore human settlements need to be part, or at least certainly be informed, so that we don't have big squatter camps developing around the industrial zones.
Honourable Oriani Ambrosini.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. DG, through you, Madam Chairman. If I understand your question, your answer to my previous question, this is not going to be an incentive game. It's going to be an infrastructure externality game. We create a big park, people will come. There was the same rationale used for Kuga. If you go back to the cabinet debate, you'll see that my party opposed it on the basis of expand rather where people are, Durban and Richards Bay, rather than spending think money for to get people where they don't want to be, and we were proven right in that respect. Now, here we have a bill that will have an operator of what will be given. In respect of the other IDZ, said there was an identifiable infrastructure, ports and the airports, and that's what they operate. Now, as I look at this, I need to have a sense of what it is that you envision that will be operated. What type of externality infrastructure? A huge packing facility, a huge plastic factory, a huge Silicon Valley for IT. So that will depend the success and the viability of the project. And also may go a long way in addressing a concern I have, and perhaps you can comment on that, that we don't want this to become little islands of subsidies. Everyone who comes here gets a nice package of subsidies because all data will do nothing but rob the entire South African people to give money to a bunch of foreign industrialists in exchange of additional employment. If that's the policy, then we need to know about it.
You actually, it's got to have been the shortest input you've made in 3 minutes. You did take me by surprise. Honourable Harris, I mean, you're welcome to that minute.
Thank you very much, Honourable Ambrosini. Excuse me if I miss someone, but I think we've only got members of the press from the Business Day here. And the Business Day wrote, perhaps last week or the year before, on the tabling of this bill, they posed one question in their editorial. It goes like this. It is essential that the government determine exactly what it is trying to achieve. Is the primary goal job creation or increased exports or perhaps a combination of the two? Now, Chair, I took a look through the presentation and through the bill, and it's very difficult to find out exactly what the government is trying to achieve here. But in the policy on page 7, there's a list of the uses for SEVs under 1.1.12. They say it ranges from export promotion, enterprise development, urban renewal, rural development, and domestic or regional production. I'd like some clarity from the DG on exactly which of these we're going to try and achieve using these zones.
Thank you very much. Now, because we're really not looking for more questions as such, are there anyone else who wants to raise a question? So now we're going to move on to the responses herein. Thank you very much. I hope the Business Day appreciates the little plug. So
thanks.
Never do that again as the DG starts talking, but you really, yeah, okay.
My apologies, but I'll never do it again. DG, in your response, maybe take us on board on what the department has in mind with the dying infrastructure in the homeland. You know, the Mofases, the Babelekis, you can go on and on the entire country.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and then I'll be assisted by the DDG here, who is recently, unlike me, who went to a Bush college, he went to Harvard, so he can try to explain some of these complex things.
I think Mr. Sello's point, and then it's just been followed up by other speakers, but all including Honourable Harris, is the question of the thing we must get right is this thing about the domestic market, the exports, and the job creation issues. And I think we're dealing with a broader misunderstanding or the debate around export orientation and so on. And I think if I can clarify this thing, as I know, you know, the labor unions especially and many others have sometimes been against what they saw as free trade or export orientation, excessive focus on exports. So, but in terms of our industrial policy approach, is that I think we misunderstand the issue, because before you can export, you must produce. Before you produce, you must employ labor. So there's absolutely no contradiction between job creation and export. In fact, if you look at the first Adam Smith, he said that the size of the market is the key factor in economic growth. Now, our market is too small. So you can't build a steel plant, and they can't only produce for the South African market, because it will be an unviable plant. You see? So you must export some part of the produce to make a manufacturing plant viable. So if you take the Toyota plant in Durban, they employ 10,000 people. But they don't only produce the Toyotas for South Africa. Of course they do, but they do, the others go to Australia and to the U.S., and that's how they can create and sustain 10,000 jobs. So I think what we see as the IDZ is that even the Chinese investors who want to come into the country to build and they are busy with the mini bus and the plant. They say that if they're going to invest in Kuga, they will obviously sell into the South African market, but they're also going to sell into the whole entire African market. And that will justify the investment, because you must have a certain minimum output. You must produce a certain number of vehicles to make yourself economically viable. So I think really what we're trying to do with the IDZ is that we're trying to create space for both servicing the domestic market, which is growing, because now that we have our full 50 million people participating in our market has grown since 94. So we are buying more cars, buying more manufactured products and so on, but it's still too small. It's only 50 million people. And we have to then service at least some parts. So exports is an essential element for these projects. But I think that as I said, the problematic model of the EPZ was, as was indicated, because they offered foreign investors such attractive conditions in the IDZ or in the EPZ, cheap labor, no labor regulations, they offered them tax holidays. They couldn't allow them to export into the domestic market because it would be unfair competition with existing companies, also private sector, who have to follow these labor laws, who have to pay these taxes. But then, so you can't let that, and that is why in the EPZ model, you had to just bring in the goods and immediately export it. You couldn't bring it into the domestic market. And as I said, that model is an unsustainable one. Because firstly, and we had it in South Africa, we have had it in where the Taiwanese came in. They only produced here and they exported everything to the U.S. because they also got a quota to allow to export into the U.S. They didn't export they didn't sell into the South African market. So they didn't sell to Edgar's and Woolworths and so on. So when the American market dried up or they closed that facility, those companies all had to close down in Isithebe because they were totally reliant on the U.S. market. And they weren't like other companies diversified with multiple markets and so on. So the key thing is to get a balance between your domestic market and your international market, and then you're not 100% reliant on only one market. So I think that's the only issue of this. I think the other issue then that Mr. Sello raised is about the private sector involvement. I think it's also very important to understand that, I mean, the principal aim of IDZ is to to attract the private sector and to create private sector investment as the lifeblood of the economy. But the private sector's role is as investors in the IDZ. Government's role is to provide the environment and the infrastructure for that investment. So we must always distinguish the public and private sector roles. Now, you can't expect the private sector to build the road and have those additional costs associated. It must entirely focus on producing cars or producing steel or into whatever it is, its core business is, must be its focus. But also you can't have some private sector people serving on the boards here, because then you're giving some inequality. For example, do you put the CEO of Toyota or the CEO of Mercedes-Benz or ArcelorMittal on the board of IDZ? No, you don't put either of them board, because they have a private interest. So you must have representatives who represent the public interest on dealing with public sector money. But the private sector's job is to invest in the IDZ. And all over the world you will see that they are all run, as I said, by in Korea, it's a minister responsible for running an IDZ or a director general level. So that is the state's role. The private sector's role is to invest in the IDZ and to create jobs. I think the important thing about, I mean, the job creation element is we again shouldn't see coming to Mr. Khadebe's point about the involvement of labor. I think, really, as I indicated, I mean, IDZ, you must be very focused on what you're going to do. And as I said, there are many forums in the country where labor is represented. For example, this bill has to go through to NEDLAC as well, where everybody will input on this legislation. There's public comments on it. So everybody can give their views and their interests can be represented. But in the actual running of the IDZ, there is no need for labor representation, because there you need people who are actually, who add value to the IDZ. And there you need, as I said, you need ESCOM and you need transport, because they must run the port or they must provide electricity, they must operate the port and so on. It's not a consultation forum. It's not to debate the labor laws and the philosophy and so on. That can be done in the appropriate forums. And that's why we're saying we must be very clear that we don't create unnecessary structures for that. I think that I maybe then also dealt with the issue of private designation. But what we do allow in the bill, and maybe our attorney can comment as well, but we do allow public-private partnerships. They are very successful models, especially for science and technology parks, where you have sometimes private companies or even universities partnering with government, public-private partnerships, who can successfully run industrial zones. But I don't think you can have a completely privately run IDZ, because then it would be, let's say Toyota decides to have an IDZ, of course they're not going to allow opportunities for their competitors so you obviously need to let an independent body run the IDZ. But as I said, we do allow for a public-private sector model, and especially as used to be said with regard to SEZs, because we could incorporate science and technology parks, industrial parks, and there it could be that a joint initiative between ourselves and the private sector. Then on the question of the Treasury, I think we now, as I said, there is a history that prior to the recession and so on, there was a worldwide debate about the use of tax incentives to promote industrial development. I think that both our Treasury, we have a common view. This piece of this went to Cabinet before we could issue it for public comment. It's gone through Cabinet Committee. It's gone through Cabinet with the active involvement of the Minister of Finance. So there is agreement that SEZs are an effective tool for development, and we need also special support for it, because even in the G20 and in the BRICS meetings, all of them have adopted this policy, and I think that there is now at least a consensus with ourselves and National Treasury on the need for dedicated incentives. But I think this is obviously the rider that we don't see incentives as the principal driving force of the IDZs. it is really much more the question of quality infrastructure that you provide. And obviously people come here also for access to markets. They invest here because they see an opportunity to both sell into the South African market and to sell into the African market. And also that's also the question of beneficiation. And that's where we see the link with the IDZ. Because of access to our raw materials, and especially there's two that's very important. The one is the iron ore that we have, and the other one is the platinum. There is work with the provinces on a platinum IDZ, where we will add value to platinum in terms of fuel cells, in terms of catalytic converters and so on. And there it will be based, because of the availability of platinum, that will attract foreign investors, because there's nowhere else in the world you can get platinum except in South Africa and in Zimbabwe. So I think that deals with that issue of beneficiation as well. I think Mr. McIntosh just, I think, emphasized the broad point about a holistic approach. I think Mr. Ambrosini, I think that I think it's just too, I mean, I think he makes the point that and I think we concur that economic viability is the ultimate, must be the criteria, not any other motives in having an IDZ. And I think we have a very clear-cut case where we had, for example, and I think where Kuha is actually a different case, because before the National Party had a choice between when they had to do the scission line from the iron ore. They could either take it to Kuha, they could either take it through the Eastern Cape or they could take it through Saldanha. They decided to do it through Saldanha, even though it was a labor-scarce area. And the Eastern Cape is not true. It is a labor-surplus area. So, and also, it has an industrial base. The Port Elizabeth industrial has been industrialized for a long time, very strong auto industry, leather industry, clothing and textile industries. So it would have been much better to, at that time already, develop the Eastern Cape. But it wasn't developed because it was not seen as important area. But it did have people, it did have labor, it did have skills, it did have an industrial base. So I think the principle is right. You must put it where the people are, where the skills are, and you must, as I said, there must be a long-term economic advantage. But for example, now that we have Saldanha built as a port, now we can exploit it properly because we now have the facility, and now, as I said, we can just add on oil and gas hub and so on. I think I've answered the question. It won't be necessarily subsidy driven, and I think I believe I've covered most of it, but let's move on.
Covered most of the questions. Did you maybe ask an issue about the capitalization of the fund? But we haven't agreed details on that. But there was a broad announcement by the Minister of Finance at the medium-term budget policy statement that they were going to set aside some funding for IDZ. I mean, within the broader economic support package that the Minister announced. But we haven't yet.
We haven't, as you said, agreed the quantum. But I think the principle has been agreed. On the need for special funds, but as I said, we still might have to fight a battle for significant resources.
Madam Chair?
I'm not sure, do you still have somebody else coming in?
Maybe we can ask Paul to, just on the current status with the transitional arrangements, I think there was a question about what happens to the current IDZs.
The transitional arrangements in the bill, which would allow them
I don't often get invited to Parliament anymore, so. But the situation with the current bills, the current zones, is they will be basically phased into the new system. If you look at
section 35 of the draft bill that deals with the transitional provisions. As you know, at the moment the IDZs work under the regulations issued under the in 2000. So designations under that will be deemed to be designations under the bill. Permits will remain in force. So they'll be basically moved into the system.
That's fine, because I know we still have a few questions on our side. Is that right? Fine, thank you. I said we still have a few questions on our side. I know you'll be first.
My question has not been answered.
Yes, we understand that, but we'll wait. We'll point to that. Are there any other questions? Any other questions before we refer back? Right, I don't see anything else. Honourable Ambrosini, yes, it was just one of yours that, from what I can see here, that's what you responded to. Perhaps you could repeat it.
That's my last one.
Yes. Just repeat your Honourable Ariani. Address the chair, please. Just raise that question again that's not responded to, because it has been overlooked, amongst two others.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I think I put it too succinctly. The question was the following: the existing IDCs will become EDCs. Understood. They've got the harbors, they've got the things, and that was the reason to make them in the first place. We're looking at orders which are beyond the existing ones. You told us that the name of the game is not incentives, but infrastructures. I ask you, what does government have in mind? Obviously, before bringing legislation, you've got some concrete aspects. Are we looking at $100 billion platinum beneficiation plant? Are we looking at $1 billion packaging facility? Are we looking at $300 billion IT, Silicon Valley, shared infrastructure for IT companies? So what are the business plans behind this legislation and the policy? Because where that leads to, shouldn't be perhaps more advisable for you to come with a single piece of legislation establishing a single one of these zones, because in any case you're giving legal personality to each of the operators, so that we as a committee and the people of South Africa, rather than giving a blank check for what could be any amount for any purpose, get to apply our mind to whether we want to have this project, this infrastructure, the other infrastructure, and so on and so forth, to promote specific sector of the economy.
Ariane Ambrosini, and it was a similar question from Honourable Salab on homelands but infrastructure, but perhaps you'd like to repeat that, Honourable Salab.
Chairperson, we all know that before 1994, we had a South Africa that was divided into homelands. And in these homelands, there were similar arrangements that we're talking about now, where investments were made in the various areas of this homeland with tax holidays, with all kinds of benefits to attract the investors to get into those places. And when we came in, we dropped those incentives, and those companies were closed. The buildings and the infrastructure remained there. It's still there today. Now my question was, in the process of this industrialization, is there anything that the department is thinking of in respect to the utilization or revival of that existing infrastructure than to start new infrastructure and leave those as they are. But whilst I'm still in this platform, Madam Chair, I wish to say the question relating to the role of private sector was not so much on that they should be part of the board only, but was to say what platform will exist for interaction between government and private sector in respect to the different roles they must play as the IGZ.
No, I think that's both. So, DG, if you would just respond, fine.
My apologies for. I think let me then start with the last one. I think then on the question of the private sector involvement from Mr. Silla, I think yes. We, as I said before, now, and we're doing it with Saldana, but I think the new approach, as I said, is long-term planning and proper studies before. And us reaching consensus on the need for SEZ. So I think what we envisage is that before we commence with any IDZ, there will be the pre-feasibility and then the full feasibility study on the long-term economic viability of an area. And I think it also addressed part of Honourable Member Ambrosini's concern. So, for example, in part of that feasibility study stage is consultation with the private sector. So, if for example, on as I mentioned, the platinum one, there's only one or two producers of platinum in South Africa. And there, we are very, Anglo Platinum is very much part of that consultation process on the establishment of a possible SEZ, because they would have to be the suppliers of the raw platinum into the SEZ. And so, similarly in Saldana, part of the feasibility study is active engagement with the, both with the private sector. So, for example, a lot of the land around the potential Saldana IDZ is owned by Mittal, by the big mining houses, and so forth. So they're not. So we're not only discussing with them the options for beneficiation, but also discussions with them on the obtaining that land for industrial development and so on. So there is a very active engagement with the private sector, because as I said, ultimately it's the private sector that must invest in this area, and so on. So there is, so that's dealing then with the question of the dying infrastructure. I think firstly the SEZ program only partially addresses that issue, but as I said, there's a mix of, and I think Mr. McIntosh referred to it, there are some of the old, let's say, regional industrial development areas that are long-term, that can still be rebuilt. But there are some which are, like, for example, if you take Atlantis, as part of the IDZ discussions now, they're looking at not only the Saldana IDZ, but the interaction even with the whole West Coast area, including Atlantis as part of that development. So I think there is now, there's been lots of development around that area, so it is possible to, I think, resurrect and redevelop the Atlantis one. Similarly, as I said, there's ones in the old Northwest province, in the Free State, where you can still revive the infrastructure and you can consolidate. Isithebe is an example where there is, as you know, the clothing industry is finally again stabilizing and potentially reviving. And then it is now possible to revive some of those old things. But there are some, like maybe, I don't know, I'm not saying without... I speak with any authority, but there are some very ones like maybe Dibaza or Botsabelo or Tabanchu. Those ones are very far located from any sort of industrial hub and so on. So, but as I said, I think the point was made, we're looking at one or two SEZs in each province. But where we locate them must be
we must first do the agree, the three tiers of government must do the pre-feasibility study, then they must do the full feasibility study. And then I think it comes into the point about, what is what is our investment plans and what is the different sectors we want to attack to different ones and so on. As I said, the feasibility studies will identify which are the viable industries that you can focus on. As I said, for example, in the Saldanha one, they've identified renewable energy as a potential industry to be created in Saldanha. They've looked at oil and gas. They've looked at beneficiation because of all the iron ore and the Sishen line coming there and so on. So, and they've looked at marine aquaculture as a potential area. It will depend, as I said, every SEZ will be different depending on what comparative advantage it has. So as I said, there will be some agro-processing one because they're in Limpopo. The one we're looking at is based because of the strong agricultural area. They're looking at that in the Free State. As I said, we're looking at platinum one. What we are saying is all three tiers of government, and especially then commitment from ESCOM. We all do the feasibility study, and as I said, we have to do this properly up front because these things are investments for 30 years. You're not creating, and so therefore you must get the exactly right up front that this thing has a long-term economic viability. So I think we can't say exactly. As I said, in some areas now, in Kuga, there's heavy focus on the automotive sector, where investments are at a very advanced stage, where people have gone and met the boards and you have, in principle, signings of investments. But, as I said, that is the bulk, 99% of the actual investment will be done by the private sector. And as I said, we will provide the infrastructure and we will provide a top-up incentive and so on. So, as I said, government is not going to invest in private companies. We have to invest in the infrastructure, and that's our contribution that we're hoping to get out of so the fund will only be money for investment in infrastructure and money for the incentives to top up private sector investment. I know I haven't fully answered Mr. Ambrosini's question, but I think the best we can do is at the same. All three tiers of government must come up with a business plan which they must present to the minister. And I think it's important to see the legislation, and a point was made earlier about the legislation is very bare. The point is industrial development you don't create jobs through a law. The law must only create enabling environment for the private sector to invest. And so we mustn't specify too much detail about you must go into this sector, you must go into that sector, and so on. No, that is for the private sector to determine whether they think they must build a steel plant here or there. And that's why I think it's important to get that. So the law mustn't be too prescriptive. It must create a governance framework for the effective management of IDZs. But it mustn't go further and prescribe which industries, which companies, what type of incentives people must get and so on. I think that we must allow the private initiative to take care of those things.
I think this is simply the first part of this process. That's all. We just had one little taste of it. It's going to be a longer process, but we at least have an opportunity to study that draft bill, which we do appreciate, which is there for discussion before we get something tabled, you know, which I think is very constructive. So, DG, I really would like to thank you and your team that you have with you, the DDG, Mr. Chapupa, and the whole team here that you brought with you today to ensure that should any question arise, you would be able to respond adequately to it. So thank you very much. For the
members of the committee. I'm sure you can see the way we are working now. Management of time has become, I think, quite constructive for all of us, because it now means we're able to close early. I mean, that's got to be the first. No. I'm not recognizing a hand unless you have a problem with the phrasing. So I do. You can see me after this.
Can I? It's a housekeeping matter.
Well, a housekeeping matter, I'll allow some time when I'm finished with my remarks. But that the last thing I need is housekeeping to interrupt me. I do enough of that. Now, if we can just carry on where we were, the time is, and I want to thank members who arrived on time. I really do. Honourable McIntosh, that may well come to you with your constructive comments last year, and also the WIP doing a very, very difficult job in ensuring members were arriving on time. And of course, Honourable Harris, you've often seen to that yourself. Okay. So I want to thank all of you in that respect. Now, just before we adjourn this meeting, you had your hand up then, Honourable Oriani, and proceed.
Yes, a concrete proposal, Madam Chairman, to you and through you to the colleagues. I think that in respect of this bill, to take it further, it might be very advantageous if you gave consideration, without responding now, to a situation where we can come and form a committee and discuss it amongst ourselves. I think that there is policy consensus that on what this bill wants to achieve. It becomes an issue how. The NC will start in a study group, the FDA will do the same, and so forth. But if we did a session as a committee, where we bounce around ideas and concerns, I suggest that we could facilitate our deliberations enormously.
Let me put it this way. We won't be holding an informal meeting in that regard. I think your point about having a meeting on this is very constructive and valuable, yes. So it won't be informal. I would rather hope that those informal discussions may take place over tea or lunch in the dining room and elsewhere. And then, as you quite rightly point out, political parties themselves will examine this in their study groups or discussion structures. And then we can come together in that meeting and simply consider the implications. I think that's what you are saying. So that, as you put it, there would appear to be some broad consensus on the principle, with certain reservations here and there from, I'm sure, all members. Sorry, I'm finding it difficult to see over a screen here at some people. But I do thank you very much, Honourable Ambrosini, on that point. And now, if I may thank you all and adjourn the meeting until, let's just get the exact date and not mislead you, until the up-to-date calendar. Until, now, I mean, this does seem a long time, and I hope some of you won't plan overseas visits that bring you back late, but it's got this Wednesday, the 8th of February, for the whole committee. Of course, prior to that, there is a subcommittee on gambling, and that is on the Thursday. But I'm sure you're all aware of that, aren't you, those who sit there? Right. And that's it, really. And then it's Wednesday, and that's it that week. So we may have possibilities, and I'm looking at yourself, Honourable Ambrosini, to look at somewhere where we could take into account some of your ideas, which are constructive, and ask the Secretary to factor it in. Thank you very much.